27th principle. The burden of debt is as destructive to freedom as subjugation by conquest. Slavery or involuntary servitude is the result of either subjugation by conquest or succumbing to the bondage of debt. Debt, of course, is simply borrowing against the future. It exchanges a present advantage for a future obligation. It will require not only the return of the original advance of funds, but a substantial compensation to the creditor for the use of his money. How debt can benumb the human spirit. The founders knew that borrowing can be an honorable procedure in a time of crises, but they deplored it just the same. They looked upon it as a temporary handicap, which should be alleviated at the earliest possible moment. They had undergone sufficient experience with debt to see its corrosive and debilitating effect, which tends to corrupt both individuals and nations. In the case of the individual, excessive debt greatly curtails the freedom of the debtor. It benumbs his spirit. He often feels hesitant to seek a new location or change a profession. He passes up financial opportunities which a free man might risk. Heavy debt introduces an element of taint into a man's search for happiness. There seems to be a perpetual burden every waking hour. There is a sense of being perpetually threatened as he rides the razor's edge of potential disaster. There is also the sense of waste, much like the man who has to make payments on a dead horse. It is money spent for pleasures or even needs that are long since past. It often means sleepless nights, recoiling under the burden of a grinding weight which is constantly increasing with every tick of the clock, and often at usurious rates. The Founder's attitude toward debt. The Founding Fathers belonged to an age when debt was recognized for the ugly specter that it really is. They considered frugality a virtue, and even when an emergency compelled them to borrow, they believed in borrowing frugally and paying back promptly. Nearly everyone finds it to his advantage or absolute necessity to borrow on occasion. Debt becomes the only available means, a necessary evil. Nevertheless, the founders wanted the nature of debt to be recognized for what it is, evil, because it is a form of bondage. As Thomas Jefferson wrote, quote, "The maxim of buying nothing without the money in our pockets to pay for it would make our country one of the happiest on earth. Experience during the war proved this, and I think every man will remember that, under all the privations it obliged him to submit to during that period, he slept sounder and woke happier than he can do now." End of quote. Debts from splurge spending. The founders felt that the worst kind of debt is that which results from splurge borrowing, going into debt to enjoy the temporary luxury of extravagantly living beyond one's means. They knew the seductive snare which this possibility presents to the person who is watching other people do it. The English author William Makepeace Thackeray reflected those feelings when he wrote these words in Vanity Fair. "How well those live who are comfortably and thoroughly in debt. How they deny themselves nothing, how jolly and easy they are in their minds." But, of course, all the reveling and apparitions of debt-financed prosperity disappear like a morning mist when it comes time to pay. Extravagant living, waste, and hazardous borrowing against the future can reduce the best of us to bankruptcy, abject poverty, and even gnawing hunger from lack of the most basic necessities of life. Universal human experience verifies the bitter reality of the parable of the prodigal son who would fain have filled his belly with the husks that the swine did eat. The kind of frugality for which the founders were famous was rooted in the conviction that debt should be abhorred like a plague. They perceived excessive indebtedness as a form of cultural disease. Benjamin Franklin on splurge spending. One of the founders who made his fortune through frugality and financial discipline was Benjamin Franklin. He had this to say concerning splurge spending. Quote, "But what madness must it be to run in debt for these superfluities? We are offered by the terms of this venue 6 months' credit, and that, perhaps, has induced some of us to attend it, because we cannot spare the ready money, and hope now to be fined without it. But, ah, think what you do when you run in debt. You give to another power over your liberty. If you cannot pay at the time, you will be ashamed to see your creditor. You will be in fear when you speak to him. You will make poor, pitiful, sneaking excuses, and by degrees come to lose your veracity, and sink into base, downright lying. For, as poor Richard says, the second vice is lying, the first is running in debt. And again, to the same purpose, lying rides upon debt's back, whereas a free-born Englishman ought not to be ashamed or afraid to see or speak to any man living. But poverty often deprives a man of all spirit and virtue. 'Tis hard for an empty bag to stand upright, as poor Richard truly says." End of quote. The Founders' Policy Concerning a National Debt. The pioneers of the American Commonwealth had the wisdom born of experience to know that the debts of a nation are no different from the debts of an individual. The fact that the indebtedness is shared by the whole people makes it no less ominous. The founders knew that dire circumstances such as war or other emergency could force a nation to borrow, so they authorized the federal government to do so in Article 1 of the Constitution. Nevertheless, they considered it a matter of supreme importance for the survival of a free people to get out of debt and enjoy complete solvency in order to prosper. This is reflected in the declaration of Thomas Jefferson when he said, quote, "I, however, place economy among the first and most important of republican virtues, and public debt as the greatest of the dangers to be feared." End of quote. Should one generation impose its debts on the next? It has always been popular in some countries to justify the practice of passing on the debts incurred by one generation to the next for payment. This was justified particularly in the case of war debts by the rationalization that since war is fought to maintain the independence and integrity of the nation, future generations should bear the burden of the cost. But this was not the view of the American founding fathers. They felt that the wars, economic problems, and debts of one generation should be paid for by the generation which incurred them. They wanted the rising generation to be genuinely free, both politically and economically. It was their feeling that passing on their debts to the next generation would be forcing the children of the future to be born into a certain amount of bondage or involuntary servitude, something for which they had neither voted nor subscribed. It would be, in the very literal sense, taxation without representation. Clearly, they said, it was a blatant violation of the fundamental republican principle. Jefferson considered an inherited debt immoral. Thomas Jefferson was particularly emphatic on this point. Said he, quote, "That we are bound to defray the war expenses within our own time and unauthorized to burden posterity with them, I suppose to have been proved in my former letter. we shall all consider ourselves morally bound to pay them ourselves, and consequently within the life expectancy of the majority. We must raise, then, ourselves the money for this war, either by taxes within the year or by loans, and if by loans, we must repay them ourselves, proscribing forever the English practice of perpetual funding. End of quote. The founders established the policy of paying debts promptly. From the founding of the nation under the new constitution, it became a policy of supreme importance to pay off the national debt. In his first term, President Washington wrote, quote, "I entertain a strong hope that the state of the national finances is now sufficiently matured to enable you to enter upon a systematic and effectual arrangement for the regular redemption and discharge of the public debt, according to the right which has been reserved to the government. No measure can be more desirable, whether viewed with an eye to its intrinsic importance or to the general sentiment and wish of the nation." End of quote. The following year, the president made it clear that this was no casual suggestion to Congress, but a matter of highest priorities. Quote, "No pecuniary consideration is more urgent than the regular redemption and discharge of the public debt. On none can delay be more injurious, or an economy of time more valuable." End of quote. Just before leaving office, Washington made a final plea to Congress to exert a greater effort to pay off the national debt, if only for the sake of the next generation. He said, quote, "Posterity may have cause to regret if, from any motive, intervals of tranquility are left unimproved for accelerating this valuable end." End of quote. The history of the American national debt. When we trace the history of the national debt, we find that the policy laid down by the founders has been followed by every generation until the present one. One of the charts accompanying this chapter reflects the annual national debt from the days of George Washington to the present. By carefully tracing the patterns of these debts, we notice that after every war or financial emergency involving heavy indebtedness, there was an immediate effort to pay it off as rapidly as possible. This policy was followed for the sake of the rising generation. The adult citizens of America wanted their children born in freedom, not bondage. In our own day, however, a different attitude toward national fiscal policies has evolved. This is not only reflected in the skyrocketing thrust of an astonishing level of national indebtedness, but it has been accompanied by an equally profligate explosion in the cost of government operations, as reflected in the chart showing outlays of the federal government 1789 to 2006. The risk in violating fundamental principles. America's contribution to mankind's 5,000-year leap was achieved by rather strict adherence to certain fundamental principles which were part of the founders' phenomenal success formula. As we have already seen, some of these most important fundamentals are being neglected, if not repudiated, in our own day. A most important area of neglect is the advice of the founders concerning national fiscal policies. As we examine the two charts included with this chapter, we find a number of notable things. First of all, as we have already observed, each generation of the past tried to pay off the national debt. In our own day, the importance of this policy has been de-emphasized. This development has occurred simultaneously with the policy of de-emphasizing the restraints and literal construction of the Constitution. Beginning with the era of the Great Depression, all three branches of the federal government used the climate of emergency to overstep their constitutional authority and aggressively undertake to perform tasks not authorized by the founders. Extensive studies by Nobel Prize-winning economist Milton Friedman have demonstrated that every one of these adventures in non-constitutional activities proved counterproductive, some of them tragically so. Secondly, the people were induced to believe that these serious aberrations of constitutional principles would provide a shortcut to economic prosperity, thereby lifting the people out of the depression. Unfortunately, it was successful only politically. It gave the people the illusion that by spending vast quantities of borrowed money, they would prosper, when, as a matter of fact, the outcome was exactly the opposite, just as the founders had predicted. Dr. Milton Friedman points out that after the federal government had spent billions of dollars and had seriously meddled with the constitutional structure of the nation, the unemployment rate was higher in 1938 than it had been in 1932. Had not the crises of World War II suddenly emerged, which required the spending of many additional billions of borrowed dollars, and also resulted in absorbing the unemployed workforce, the physical failure of the New Deal experiments would be better remembered by the American people. Splurge spending is habit forming. It is highly significant that the political formula which Harry Hopkins recommended to keep a particular administration in power was tax, tax, spend, spend, elect, elect. Once the people have been encouraged by their political leaders to indulge in splurge spending, the result is like a snowball rolling downhill. It increases in size and gains in speed. This is dramatically demonstrated in the charts. It will be noted that the national budget was less than $100 billion in 1960. Today we spend almost that much just for interest on the national debt, and that is more than the entire cost of World War II in real dollars. Since 1970, the national debt has tripled. Today we are spending the next generation's inheritance. The figures in these charts are astonishing, but not nearly as significant as the trend of thinking among the American people, which the figures represent. For the first time in the entire history of the United States, a generation of Americans is squandering the next generation's inheritance. With the national debt at $1 trillion, there is no way in the foreseeable future whereby this generation could possibly liquidate such a mountain of accumulated debt. The problem is aggravated by the fact that this generation has also committed itself to pay off additional liabilities in the future, amounting to approximately $11 trillion. Since 1972, an effort has been made to compute precisely how extensive these commitments really are. But it is feared that they may turn out to be even more than the $11 trillion which present tabulations indicate. The problem of the fix. Of course, the founders would understand exactly what this generation is doing to itself. It is the very essence of human nature to pursue this disastrous course once the appetite has been created to demand it. As a result, American taxpayers now discover themselves playing a role almost identical to that of an addict on hard drugs. The addict denounces his habit and despises the pusher who got him into it. But when he is confronted with the crises of needing a fix, he will plead with tears of anguish for the narcotic remedy. The fix, of course, is not a remedy at all. The real remedy is withdrawal. The addict must escape from the torturous cycle of vicious repetition, which is not solving his problem but compounding it. If withdrawal is painful, at least it is not prolonged. The problem is primarily a matter of willpower, the determination to change. Every aspect of this reprehensible example applies to the mood of the American masses during recent years. Polemics against the government's profligate spending are vehement. The denunciation of high taxes is virtually universal. From banker to ditch digger, it is eloquently explained how this entire syndrome of big spending, high taxes, oppressive government regulations, and mountainous debt is stifling the economy, inhibiting the rate of production, and stagnating the wholesome development of the traditional American lifestyle. Yet, with all of that, any congressman will verify that it has been, at least until recently, almost political suicide to try to change the trend. When it comes to cutting programs and reducing costs, balancing the budget, and eliminating deficit spending, it is amazing how few will make the necessary adjustment without the most violent outcries of protest when it affects them personally. But then, this would come as no surprise to the founders. It is called human nature. They would know that the only solution is to develop the willpower to make the change. This is not easy, but it can be done. How can the United States return to the founders' formula? In recent years, the number of Americans who have become reconciled to the inescapable necessity of returning to the founders' formula has risen to millions. The very circumstances in which the American taxpayer finds himself are sufficient to awaken many to recognize the physical bottomless pit into which the nation is sinking. The vivid shock of that realization is precisely what is needed to arouse the majority of the people to the point where they are willing to go through physical withdrawal and kick the habit of splurge spending. However, congressmen, the president, and the taxpayers are all asking the same question. Is there any way this can be accomplished without our going through the ringer of a deep depression? This writer believes that there is. By returning to the fundamental principles espoused by the founding fathers, we can reverse the trend and get America back to a formula of prosperity economics without a major crunch or depression. The outline for such a plan has already been submitted to the appropriate channels in Congress, and these proposals will be included in a forthcoming book entitled The Healing of the Nation.